Most every problem has its pieces, ways it can be broken down and carried, hopefully solved. But with very big problems, solutions require more than just the simple assemblage of learned facts. Try taking a little trip to Mars, 140 million miles away. Even if your spaceship completes the journey, catastrophic failure on entry, landing, or descent is only 10 degrees away. For the people who take on problems like this, the stakes couldn't be higher. Our guest today is one such person, part of a team of engineers that recently put 2,000 pounds of human ingenuity on the surface of Mars, the Curiosity rover. He says that when a loose screw can cost billions, it's all the more important to be the right kind of crazy. That's the title of his new memoir, about life as an engineer for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, part of the California Institute of Technology, which supports a much better known acronym, NASA. He's worked on some of the most high-profile spaceflight missions of recent years, including Galileo, Cassini, the Mars Pathfinder, and the Mars Curiosity rover. He was the phase leader and development manager for the Mars Science Laboratory and the Curiosity's entry, descent, and landing phase. He helped design, build, and test the Sky Crane landing system. He joins us now on the line to discuss his new book, The Right Kind of Crazy, a true story of teamwork, leadership, and high-stakes innovation. Adam Steltzner, welcome to The Exchange.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
It's my pleasure. This really mainlines into some space geekness, if you'll pardon the term. We're very pleased to have you here.
Great.
So, Adam, do you think of yourself as an unlikely or an accidental rocket scientist?
Yeah. Certainly. I wouldn't have, you know, at the age of 5 or 10 or 15, I wouldn't, or even 20, I would not have imagined myself being where I am today. And I was, although there was, you know, in retrospect, there was some nascent interest in stuff that is rocket science-like, I would never have imagined that I would be doing what I'm doing or involved in the kind of field that I am.
Yeah. How did you go from, you know, fronting a rock band to the valedictory address at UC Davis's College of Engineering? At what age did you start to see yourself as a rocket scientist or a potential one?
Well, I was returning home from playing a show one night at 21 years of age, and I noticed that in the night sky, the stars were in a different spot than they had been when I went out to play the show. And I had not been paying much attention in high school. I'd missed the whole Earth spinning on its axis thing. And I was curious as to why the stars were moving. I didn't think that the Earth was moving. I thought that the stars were moving. And I was, you know, I guess, bored enough and frustrated enough with my wannabe rock star life that I went to the local community college to see if I could take a class that would teach me why the stars were moving. And it had associated with it a physics course. And thankfully it was physics for poets, physics without math. And so I took that class, and the time was right, and it blew my mind. And it opened up and sparked a curiosity that infected me and, motivated me to go back to school to remedy my sort of deficient high school education and eventually continue on through a PhD and be working at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory landing stuff on Mars.
A lot to cover there. Before we move on from your youth, though, I'm curious, what are some examples of bad advice you got as a young person now that you are, you know, a preeminent rocket scientist? What bad advice did you get, and what bad advice do you still hear echoed today?
Well, certainly this notion that, which has been with us for centuries, that you understand at some early age, like in your teens, what's a good thing for you to embark on, a career path, you know, all of the many well-intentioned high school guidance counselors, my parents, that bought into the fiction that I was selling, which was, I'm not a good student. I'm not good with math. I'm really of an artistic bent. And everybody was like, okay, that sounds okay. And let me off the hook for trying. And had this, that sort of all played into this sort of common fiction that that kids should know what they want to do when they grow up. I think now researchers say, you know, tell us that the human brain is not really fully developed into the mid-20s of where your adult mind is really formed. And so, you know, we're really not ready to figure it out yet, but the way that our education system is set up, it sort of demands it of us. And so you still hear that today. So I don't know. I've got a 13-year-old daughter, a 3-year-old daughter, and a son that's due in March. And so we will see how I navigate advising them and if I can maintain the flexible, liberal, and understanding attitude that I currently hold when they get into their late teens and early 20s.
Hey, and it seems like with a 13-year-old, you'd already be well underway there. Has your mindset been challenged at all by, say, a 13-year-old who knows for a fact that she wants to be a pop star or or something else, somewhat unlikely, like a rocket scientist?
Right. So my daughter doesn't have that certainty. And I and her mother, my ex-wife, have not demanded of her that she make a choice. So whether she wants to be a scientist, an artist, a performer, any of those, you know, anything is available to her. The thing that I want her to be, most important thing I want her to be in life is a happy, well-adjusted adult someday.
Well, Curiosity and Physics for Poets are just the beginning of this hour with Adam Steltzner. His new memoir is called The Right Kind of Crazy, a true story of teamwork, leadership, and high-stakes innovation. It talks of Steltzner's career as an aerospace engineer, notably recently working on the Mars Exploration Rover project, which landed on the red planet in 2012. We'll get to that and so much more with Adam Steltzner. Phone number and email address, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I'm Emily Curitan, and this is the Jefferson Exchange. We will be back after a very short break. On the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Steltzner. I'm your host, Emily Curitan. You can join the discussion, 800-838-3760, or email us jx@jeffnet.org. We're talking about Mars today. It's really exciting. Adam Steltzner, you're just talking about kind of your unlikely youth. You ended up graduating valedictorian at UC Davis. And then I'm taking, this is the late 80s, maybe the early 90s. At that time, where did an aerospace engineer who didn't want to build a weapon system find work?
Yeah, that's a good one. And it was a bit of a conundrum or a challenge. You know, it was Star Wars, the Reagan era. There was a lot of work in weapon systems, and I was not interested in that. I went to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena and tried to get a job there because, you know, we are private employees of the California Institute of Technology, Caltech, but we contract with the federal government and we work for NASA.
With the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, even though,
yes,
of course, it's a very well-known acronym at this point. So Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, based in Southern California, it started as a dry creek bed. Am I correct there?
Yes, it still is in a dry creek bed.
Uh-huh.
Some early graduate students, actually, at Caltech were experimenting in rocket fuel and rocket propulsion. And in order for them to not blow up everybody in Pasadena, they sent them to a dry riverbed at the edge of town and told them to do their work there. And that was the nucleus of what would become the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Started out in the early days, it was an Army lab during the war, and then when NASA was created, it became part of NASA. But unlike the other centers where they're government employees, we work for Caltech, and we are what's called a FFRDC, Federally Funded Research and Development Center, much akin to Sandia National Labs or the Lawrence Livermore Labs or something.
So what are some of JPL's claims to fame over the history of space exploration?
Well, JPL has contributed the vast majority of the U.S. unmanned space mission. So robots going into space, they could be the Mariners, they could be the Voyagers, all of those fantastic, you know, Pioneer, Voyager, these fantastic images of Saturn, of Jupiter, of Jupiter's moons, Cassini, Galileo, Mars Pathfinder, Mars Exploration Rovers, the Mars Curiosity Rover. All of these missions have been from JPL. So we have brought to the nation and the people of the world sort of the closest views of a lot of the planets in our solar system.
So the time that you came on in the early 90s, that was a period of great overhaul or reform for aerospace engineering and NASA programs. Is that correct?
Yes, that is. You know, we had over the years, there's sort of more risk-embracing experimental culture that had been sort of underpinned our activities in the 60s and 70s became more sort of stolid and expecting or demanding higher certainty of success, which drove a different culture. It drove more process, more double checks, and more expense. You know, if you want to get something 50% right, you can take some big gambles. If you want to get it 90% right, you can still take a lot of gambles. If you want 99% right, the cost and everything goes very much higher. And if you want 99.9% likely to be successful, you're adding factors of tens of on top of the cost and the effort. And so we found ourselves, I think, in the 90s of sort of slightly NASA at large of sort of laboring under our demands for certain success. And we got a new administrator at that time named Dan Golden. He came from private industry, and he came with this idea that maybe we should try to look for new risk-embracing methods of doing our exploration that can drive down costs radically. By accepting maybe 90% or 80% success rate, maybe we can drop the costs by a factor of 10.
Right, but how do you learn from your mistakes if they cost? I mean, even a factor of 10 of $2 billion is still a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, but it's still a factor of 10. And if you get a chance to do, let's say, five times as many experiments when they're one-tenth as much, so you're spending half what you were spending before, but you're getting five cracks at it, that's a lot more opportunities to learn from your mistakes and a lot more opportunities to do great science.
We're talking with Adam Steltzner. His new memoir is called The Right Kind of Crazy, a true story of teamwork, leadership, and high-stakes innovation. Adam is an engineer who works at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California, part of Caltech. And Adam, talking about this shift in culture around exploration and aerospace engineering in the 90s and going into the early 2000s, what inspired you about the leadership you saw, say, behind the Mars Pathfinder?
Oh, well, these guys were totally embracing the better, faster, cheaper. That's what Dan Golden came up with a saying to describe this risk-embracing, lower-cost fashion of doing business. He called it better, faster, cheaper, and Mars Pathfinder Project embraced that. And I witnessed mostly from afar. I helped on Pathfinder, but in a relatively minor role. But I witnessed the management style, these very full-bodied, intellectually aggressive exchanges, and a lot of personal ownership. personal ownership of risk, personal ownership of the quality of the final product. And that was exciting, and I wanted to be part of it.
And this is where you first met Dara Sabahi, who would become an important leader for you on the Mars missions, right?
Absolutely. This is where I first saw him at work, and I liked what I saw. And it would be really in the Champollion project, which got canceled before it really came into fruition, where I'd have my first chance to work intimately with Dara.
But what a sexy mission. I'm glad you brought up Champollion. Harpooning a comet.
Yes.
Can we talk more about that? You know, why would you want to stab a comet, first of all?
Great. Well, we didn't know what a comet surface was going to look like. And we thought it might be very rough, very jagged. We knew that it might have pockets of gas flowing out of it, because as a comet gets closer to the sun, it evaporates. It puts off dust and gases as the volatiles in the comet's nucleus vaporize. And so we wanted to rely on the least amount of information possible about what the surface of a comet would look like in order to be successful. That is to say, we wanted our landing architecture to need to be as robust as possible to the uncertainty that we might find in the actual surface when we really got to the comet. We reasoned that one of the ways to do that was to interact the least with the comet. Take the smallest possible footprint.
Uh-huh. And the least amount of unknown unknowns.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And so you isolated a way to do this, but the mission never actually got to stab the comet.
We never got to stab the comet. We developed the harpooning system and tested it out. But as is the case, unfortunately, you know, not infrequently in our business, we never got to full mission status, and so the team disassembled and went on to do work other things.
Well, in The Right Kind of Crazy, your new memoir, you single out the Champollion mission not for its sort of sexy culmination, but as your first act of self-authorization in the leadership structure of this new JPL, this new structure for NASA. Can you talk more about what self-authorization meant to you?
Yes. It was the first time that I stepped away from an analyst role, somebody who gets handed a question, does some calculation, comes up with an answer, and hands it back. I stepped out of that role and into a leadership role by authorizing myself to do so, by asking questions that I thought we needed to ask, even though nobody was asking me to ask those questions, by recommending ways of working on our problem that involved the work efforts of several other people without being asked explicitly to figure out what those several other people should do, but just reasoning my way through what self-authorization means to me today is, and it's necessary in a highly effective team, it's necessary at all levels, at leadership positions and at any position in the team. Self-authorization is about putting your ideas forward for this common effort that you're working on as a team. Putting your ideas forward, even though those ideas might disrupt the status quo and result in changes to what the plans are. So putting, you know, speaking up, saying what you think is right, and authorizing yourself to be a potential disruptor of the status quo. And that's what I did for the first time ever on Champollion.
We've got some calls here on the line. I'd like to go to them now. Mark in Reading has been waiting. Mark, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. You're on the air with Adam Stelzner.
Yes, I'm wondering what amount of effort do you have to take to protect your equipment from solar and cosmic radiation, and how much more complex is it when dealing with human beings in space?
Yes, so great question, Mark. We do have to take quite a bit of effort to look out for cosmic rays and solar radiation, in general, the radiation environment of space. Our electronics are different than we would be if we were operating down here on Earth. And because of that, we tend to operate with relatively low tech. There's a lag. You can't get the computer chips today that are being manufactured or invented today in a radiation-hardened form, but in 5 or 10 years, somebody might have turned around and generated the same chip, but now in a computer in a radiation-hardened form. So we take special measures with our electronics and our systems, and for humans, that's a challenge. When we study putting humans into space, into deep space and to Mars, the radiation dosage is one of the central challenges. And shielding them is difficult. You can use things like water, but it takes an awful lot of water to shield human beings against the radiation environment. So that's one of the big challenges with, it's not insurmountable, but it is one of the big challenges with human exploration.
And speaking of the challenges, we can't really even count them. I imagine you get quite a bit of deference for being able to solve the problems that you've solved. You talk about speaking up, self-authorizing, and following your gut, really, on some of these huge projects. How do you reach decisions when there are so many factors to consider and the margin of error is so very small? Too big?
In a word?
Yeah.
Carefully. But seriously, when you are operating at the edge of what is possible, you really need everything that you can bring to bear. That involves the conscious mind. It involves the subconscious mind. That's that thing that we call our gut at times. And it involves the advice of others.
Uh-huh.
Advice of others is very important. And the advice of others who are not bought into what you're doing. So at JPL, we do a range of approaches that, which also certainly includes external review by non-advocate, non-believers, as they would be,
mm-hmm.
to push our ideas around and make sure that what we're thinking about doing is really the right step.
Well, speaking of expanding the edge of what's possible, your team certainly did that with the Mars Exploration Rover, a 2,000-pound craft landing on the surface of the planet in 2012. We've got Grumpy John and Grants Pass on the line. Let's let Grumpy John have the first question here about Mars and the missions to it. Hi, Grumpy John. This is the Fussy Button.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Exchange. Good morning.
Thank you very much. Sir, I would like to save you a ton of money, and I would like you to promise to use the excess on exploration of our oceans because they're much more accessible and we know less about them. Here is my suggestion. Rather than send a lake of fuel up with the rocket to Mars so that you can bring the people back, please, sir, find yourself some scientists who are terminally ill so that it is a known one-way trip. You can provide them with all the comforts of home if you're not carrying a huge lake of returned fuel. That way, they can be there. They know that they're not going to live all that long anyway. There is not going to be a return flight. With the money you save on that, they can live in comfort, and you can explore the oceans, which is something that we can all participate in because we don't have to be lifted into space to look around for it. So please, terminally ill scientists will volunteer to go on your mission. You can have and that way you get your humans on Mars, and we get the benefit of exploring a place that we could actually reach.
All right, Grumpy John, thank you for that. We got it. Quite an idea there, although unpacking a little bit of what Grumpy John said, I have questions myself about why do we go to Mars? You want to take that one or any piece of Grumpy John's plan there, Adam Stelzner?
Great. Certainly. So first, to Grumpy John's point, Grumpy John, we're thinking about that. Of course, not necessarily terminally ill candidates, but people who are willing to not return. That has a potentially large social implication, which we could spend the next 17 hours discussing and not be done with it. And so it's complex for an I think probably for a nation as the size of that we have and the of the of the ideological diversity of this great nation of ours to probably overcome, but nonetheless, certainly a very practical, a potentially practical solution, and would help. Although you know, humans are sensitive and they still need water and air and all that sort of stuff, and so it still costs quite a bit. Exploring the oceans, I don't think I want to make the exploration of our oceans, which is a very, very important, initiative. And actually, there's a new initiative at NASA called Ocean Worlds, which identifies many waterborne destinations throughout our solar system and is sort of redoubling our efforts to look at those, the first of which, of course, is planet Earth. And so I share your enthusiasm and desire for us to be exploring and doing more exploration of our oceans. Actually, I've spent some time with Dr. Bob Ballard, one of the most famous ocean explorers, and he and I go back and forth very frequently about the need for improved and increased exploration of our oceans. To the question of why we explore at all,
yeah,
I think that's an interesting one.
And we may have to get to it after a break, but let's hear the nutshell explanation, maybe 15 or 20 seconds here.
I think we explore fundamentally as a gesture of our humanity because we can.
Because it's there, right?
Yep.
All right. More from Adam Steltzner after a short break. His new memoir is called The Right Kind of Crazy, a true story of teamwork, leadership, and high-stakes innovation. We are going to Mars on the final segment of the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. On the Jefferson Exchange, and our final segment with Adam Steltzner, an engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California, part of Caltech, and a federally funded research center for NASA. Steltzner worked on the Curiosity rover, which landed on Mars in 2012. Pretty big deal, folks. You can join this discussion, 800-838-3760, or email us jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Adam, we were just getting into, for me, one of the more exciting projects of my lifetime, the Mars Exploration Rover. When did you become the project manager for this?
So I took on the—I started working on the rover itself. Her name would be Curiosity, but it wasn't yet Curiosity when I started. And then in 2005, I was asked to lead the effort of landing her, of developing our landing system, and that was a big jump for me. It was leading all of the engineering systems, and of course the landing is the most risky phase of the mission,
uh-huh.
and the one for which sort of. It's a make-or-break moment.
Right. So, you had been more involved with descents. Is that accurate before this?
Correct. Uh-huh. That's correct. With the twin rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, I'd worked the mechanical engineering of the entry, descent, and landing systems. But for Curiosity, this would be the first time that I would be stepping up to engineering, to being in charge of the engineering of all the systems.
So your problem was to get Curiosity onto the surface of the planet. Just so we understand the stakes here, what was the idea behind the Curiosity once it got there, assuming you could do your job?
Well, so Curiosity is packed full to the gills with all of the science instruments we needed to ask and answer the question, was the ancient environment of Mars habitable for life? A huge, profound question. To pack all that in a rover, it meant that the rover was the size of a car.
How much did it weigh?
The rover was the size of an automobile, of a Mini Cooper. So this is bigger than anything we've landed on another planet. And so the landing system was going to have to be new. It was a challenge.
I would say that sounds like an understatement. You know, among the challenges, what was the greatest one facing the landing team?
Well, the greatest one was the final step. You You know, if you want to land on Mars, you basically have to do four things. You hit the atmosphere going 10,000 to 15,000 miles an hour, and you could burn up and melt. So you wrap the spacecraft in a special aeroshell that protects it from the intense heat. You coat it with material that smolders but will not burn. And you shed all of that energy of motion, all that kinetic energy, into the atmosphere, sort of burning a hole in the sky of Mars. That slows you down to about 1,000 miles an hour. Not slow enough to land, so you open up a parachute. Supersonically, for Curiosity, we opened up the world's largest supersonic parachute. That slows you down to a couple hundred miles an hour or so, not slow enough to land, and then you go to rockets. Let go of the parachute and you go to rockets. Every time we've gone to Mars, we've used all three of those systems, and then you need one final system. We call it the touchdown system or the landing system that takes the final residual bump, the sort of the kiss with the Martian surface, the 1 to 10 mile an hour or so bump with the Martian surface.
Wow. So wait, just to recap, so we started at 15,000 miles an hour, and how much distance is covered by the time you've got to get this thing down to 10 miles an hour?
So in miles, about 500 miles.
Uh-huh.
So we are going, we're screaming across the sky of Mars, decelerating, descending, and then when we get just down to the surface, we've got some residual error velocity, some final little bit of speed to park or to kiss the Martian surface. For the little Sojourner rover and for Spirit and Opportunity, we used airbags to cushion that final blow. They hit at about 20 miles an hour or so. For Curiosity, because she was the size of a car, there were no fibers known to humankind from which we could make a bag that would be strong enough to handle the loads. So we had to go to something different. And what we came up with was something that we called the Sky Crane.
The Sky Crane. Why is the Sky Crane an unlikely solution to this problem?
Well, it was, as my friend and mentor Gentry Lee said, the least unacceptable solution.
Uh-huh. How so?
Well, we had to lower the rover below the descent stage. Think of a jet backpack on top of the rover. We fly the vehicle all the way to about 70 feet above the surface, and then we separate the rover from the jet backpack and lower it. There's the crane part of Sky Crane. Lower it below the jet backpack as both vehicles continue to descend to the surface. And then the rover is gently placed on the surface, wheels down at about 1.5 miles an hour, 1 3/4 of a mile an hour, a brisk walking pace. And then the descent stage cuts itself free from the bridles, the tethers that had been holding the rover, and flies off to a safe distance. That maneuver, called the Sky Crane, it looked crazy to folks when we would describe it to them. And, in fact, the NASA administrator dragged us back to D.C., to Washington, to tell him why we thought it was the right idea. That ended up being my job to do that speech. And when I got done with it, I think he still thought it. I don't think he liked it. But he said, you know, I still think it's crazy, but it might be crazy enough to work. It might be the right kind of crazy. And there's the title of the book.
That is the title of Adam Stelzner's new memoir, The Right Kind of Crazy. As we're discussing, it details missions to Mars. And this Sky Crane that got a bigger rover than had ever been landed before onto the surface of the planet, where did the inspiration for this kind of this design that maybe on first blush people may have laughed at, and it ended up working, where did the inspiration come from?
Well, it's interesting. You know, it was a group effort. There was maybe a dozen of us in the room when we conceived of this notion. It came from sort of thinking about our missions to the surface of Mars, where we had used airbags, and taking away from those other architectures all that wouldn't work, and leaving us with this idea that we had banded around for a few years called Rover on a Rope. Rover on a Rope wouldn't work, and it was over a two-day period of time in the fall of 2003 with a dozen of us or so in the room that we sort of all came across this notion of lowering the rover below the jet backpack while it was on rocket power. That was the big epiphany we all had, and it just sort of came to all of us sort of simultaneously.
And it sounds like you had to deeply commit to the idea in order to sell it to your superiors and get them on board with using something that hadn't been practically applied on a $2.5 billion project. How did you know you weren't too in love with an idea?
Well, you know, that's a very important one to make sure that you're not so in love with. It's actually the most important thing is to make sure that you're not in love with your own idea so much that it blinds you. And one of the techniques that we use is we bring external people, non-believers, non-advocates into the room and ask them for their opinion. And we did that with the SkyTrain. We conducted a three-day external review. We had the Aerospace Corporation assemble the board, and it was completely independent. And they got, you know, we constructed our best arguments as to why we thought it was the right solution. And when they got done, they kind of had the same answer, which was, boy, it sure does look crazy, but we can't see anything wrong with it.
Mm. Time for a few more calls here with Adam Steltzner. We're talking about getting to Mars, opening up the final frontier. Bring your space travel questions our way, 800-838-3760, or email jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Adam, any wise words about the wisdom that maybe you've gleaned from operating at the highest echelons of rocket science for how problems can be approached, no matter how big or how small?
Sure. I think one of the important things I learned early in my life, and I've been watching it replay itself again and again and again, is this idea of making sure that we're using all of our curiosity to interrogate the question at hand. I call it hold on to the doubt. And what I mean by that is that frequently having a question in front of us, and it can be anything. It can be, I can be a small business owner and wanting to wonder if I should, whether I should venture into a new market or not. It's to allow ourselves to be comfortable with the open question. So frequently I found in my own experience, and I watched it in others, the open question makes us anxious, and we tend to rush to close it because we don't want to sit with the uncertainty as to whether we will be able to close it. And that makes what I call fear-based decision-making, where we sort of make the decision, the sort of the quickest one we can, because we don't want to sit with the open question.
Mm, and how do the outcomes of decisions based on curiosity tend to differ from those based on fear?
Well, I can tell you that the SkyTrain actually finally came when we sat with the question long enough to recognize the answer. We had discounted solutions similar to the SkyTrain in previous brainstorming sessions because we'd wanted to get to a different answer and we hadn't sat with the open question long enough. So they just tend to be, in my experience, those the results you get when you engage in curiosity-based decision-making tend to be a little deeper, they tend to be a little more profound, and they tend to work.
So take us to the final 7 minutes of a mission that was decades in the making, really. How did you feel as you waited to see if the SkyTrain would work and the rover would actually make it onto the surface of Mars?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. From what I understand, professional athletes spend a lot of time visualizing success before they engage in whatever they're doing. And that's because that visualization can help make them more successful. Unfortunately for us, for all the members of my team, we visualize failure because visualizing failure helps us choose to make a countermeasure or do something differently to avert that failure. because the spacecraft's going to be doing this autonomously. It's going to be, it's an automatic robot. We're not going to be able to intervene. So we spend all of our time thinking about how it fails.
So what kinds of failures are you visualizing now? I mean, what's next for your explorations and for your team?
Well, we're going to go back to the surface of Mars with a big rover that looks a lot like Curiosity, but this time we're going to take samples of the Martian soil and rocks. We're going to drill, take cores out of the Martian rocks, seal them in special, sterile, hermetically sealed cylinders for eventual return to Earth. The scientists tell us to really unlock the question of whether Mars was alive or not. We have to bring up samples of Mars back to Earth.
So for that return, are you thinking a manned mission?
The return would be that we have envisioned a robotic return. I'd love it if a human being brings them back. But if a manned mission's not available, we are prepared to do it with robots.
And what have you learned from the Curiosity rover's exploration since it landed in 2012? What are some of the big ahas to come out of that success?
Well, the biggest aha is that within 6 months, she had answered the question that she was sent to ask, the question of, was the ancient water born? Because we know from the twins' Spirit and Opportunity that there was water flowing on the surface of Mars. But we didn't know some important pieces of it. And so Curiosity was sent to ask, was that early wet environment habitable? And within 6 months of being on the surface, she drilled a hole into the bedrock of Mars, produced powder, sifted it carefully, sent those pieces of powder to instruments within the belly of the rover, and received the data that told scientists here on Earth that the answer is yes. The early waterborne environment, the ancient environment of Mars, would have been habitable for life.
And the Earth changed as we knew it. We've had Adam Steltzner on the program today, and it has been a real treat. Adam is the author of The Right Kind of Crazy, A True Story of Teamwork, Leadership, and High-Stakes Innovation. It's out now. Adam, thanks so much for being on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, and we'll go out with some music from Old Blue Eyes. It's actually the song that Adam played when they were waiting to see if the Curiosity rover would be a success or a very expensive failure.